Hello, everyone, and welcome to the reading of Science Today. I'm Alan Corbett, volunteer reader for Virginia Voice, and today we're going to start with this very up-to-date article entitled Webb Telescope Detects a Possible Signature of Life on a Distant World. And this is written by Joel Achenbach from the April 17th, 2025 edition of the Washington Post. A distant planet's atmosphere shows signs of molecules that on Earth are associated only with biological activity, a possible signal of life on what is suspected to be a watery world, according to a report published on Wednesday that analyzed observations by NASA's James Webb Space Telescope. The peer review report in the Astrophysical Journal Letters presents more questions than answers and acknowledges numerous uncertainties and does not declare the discovery of life beyond Earth, something never conclusively detected. But the authors do claim to have found the best evidence to date of a possible biosignature on a planet far from our solar system. The planet is known as K2-18b and is 124 light years away, orbiting a red dwarf star. Earlier observations suggested that its atmosphere is consistent with the presence of a global ocean. The molecule purportedly detected is dimethyl sulfide, or DMS. On Earth, it is produced by the decay of marine phytoplankton and other microbes and has no other known source. The astronomers want to observe the planet further to strengthen the evidence that the molecule is present. The lead author of the new paper, Niku Madhusudan, is an astrophysicist at the University of Cambridge in England and repeatedly urged reporters in a briefing to be cautious in describing the new research. But his warning bracketed more dramatic statements. This possible detection of a biosignature could be potentially one of the biggest landmarks in the history of science, Madhusudan said. This is the first time humanity has ever seen biosignature molecules, potentially biosignature molecules, which are biosignatures on Earth, in the atmosphere of a habitable zone planet. He added, the habitable or Goldilocks zone is the distance from a star that could allow water to remain liquid at the planet's surface. K2-18b, which is within our galaxy, the Milky Way, cannot be seen by any telescope at a discrete object, but it has a fortuitous orbit that crosses its path star, It has a fortuitous orbit that crosses its parent star as seen from Earth, and such transits dim the starlight ever so slightly, which is how many exoplanets have been discovered. The transits also change the starlight spectrum in a pattern that, if observed with instruments on a telescope as advanced as the Webb, can reveal the composition of the planet's atmosphere. In 2023, Madhusudan and colleagues reported that the two instruments on the web had detected carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere of K2-18b, as well as hints of DMS. His team observed the planet for an additional 8 hours last April using the web's mid-infrared instrument. The resulting data boosted their confidence that DMS, or an almost identical molecule, dimethyl disulfide, which is DMDS, or possibly both, are present. The paper describes the result as an important step forward in the search for signatures of life on exoplanets, but it adds that strengthening the finding will need a dedicated community effort in multiple directions, observational, theoretical, and experimental. In a news release, Cambridge University stated, "While an unknown chemical process may be the source of these molecules in K2-18b's atmosphere, the results are the strongest evidence yet that life may exist on a planet outside our solar system." Even if further observations strengthen the case that K2-18b has an atmosphere that contains DMS, the scientific community would probably want a great deal more evidence that this is truly a biosignature and not something with an abiotic origin. A molecule glimpsed in the air of a planet 729 trillion miles away is a thin reed upon which to rest what would be the historic discovery of alien life. The Webb Telescope is an international collaboration among NASA and the space agencies of Europe and Canada, but the agencies have not sought coverage of the new findings, an indication that the community wants to see more data and more robust evidence before saying anything about possible alien life. NASA did not comment on the paper, but instead provided a statement about Webb's search for biosignatures. "Finding biosignatures, or gases produced only by life, is challenging for Webb. This requires tens to hundreds of hours of observing time for a single planet, and the results may not be conclusive due to evolution of the star and the planet atmosphere over time, and the planet's Webb can search orbit relatively inhospitable stars," the NASA statement said. "Finding life elsewhere in the universe will also be a process, and detection of a single potential biosignature would not constitute discovery of life," the statement added. The search for extraterrestrial life has had many false positives over the ages. In the early 20th century, astronomer Percival Lowell assured the world that Mars was laced with canals. In 1976, an experiment on NASA's Viking lander showed tantalizing signs of possible microbial activity, but other tests showed that the surface appears sterile. Reports of alien spaceships visiting Earth, the topic of many incredulous media reports, as well as congressional hearings with more than a whiff of nonsense, invariably crash upon the unforgiving turf of the scientific method. Astronomers studying K2-18b will need to answer three basic questions before the broader scientific community may accept they have indeed discovered a biosignature. Sarah Seeger, an astrophysicist and leading figure in the study of exoplanets, said in an email, number one, is the signal real? Number two, is it correctly attributed to the proposed gas, or could other gases produce the same feature? And number three, can the gas be produced without life? Even if the first two questions were answered satisfactorily, she said, the third may never be fully resolved with the limited data exoplanets offer. Her bottom line assessment, not yet a biosignature, but a timely prompt to sharpen our method and expectations. Madhusudan told reporters that DMS is abundant on K2-18b and that there is no known chemical mechanism to produce the molecule at the level other than through biological processes. Either we are looking at a new chemical process that we haven't seen before, or we are witnessing the first signs of biological activity outside of Earth, says Måns Holmberg, a co-author of the report and a postdoctoral researcher at the Space Telescope Science Institute. The solar system may harbor life in hidden realms, such as beneath the surface of Mars, or on the ice-crusted moons of Jupiter or Saturn. NASA's Europa Clipper spacecraft launched in October in what will be a multi-year mission to study the Jovian moon, believed to have a subsurface ocean with as much water as all the oceans on Earth. Life exploits elements common in the universe. Planets are now known to be abundant, and stars can burn for billions of years as reliable power sources. The universe may be primed for life. The first planets outside our solar system were detected just 30 years ago, and since then, astronomers have discovered thousands. K2-18b was first discovered by NASA's Kepler Space Telescope in 2015. The planet orbits its parent star, a small, relatively cool one known as a red dwarf, in just 33 days. The planet's diameter is about 2.5 times that of Earth. K2-18b's orbit around the star, which puts it about 1/7 of Earth's distance from the Sun, is within the habitable zone of its planetary system. Observations by the Webb suggest that it has a hydrogen-rich atmosphere and a liquid ocean vastly deeper than on any of our planets. Such planets have been dubbed Hycean worlds. Hycean is a portmanteau derived from hydrogen and ocean. His team is hoping for additional observation time with the Webb to strengthen the case that the DMS detection is real. Beyond the question of whether there is life on K2-18b is the more speculative question of what form that life might take. On Earth, life remained one-celled for several billion years, before the appearance of anything as complex as a clam. K2-18b is about 2.4 billion years old. Emily Mitchell, a biologist at the University of Cambridge, who was not part of the new paper but has collaborated with its authors, said K2-18b is warmer than Earth, and the evolution of life there could be a more rapid progress than on our planet. That doesn't mean fish or crabs or sharks exist, but the planet might have relatively complex microbes, she said. It's very, very speculative, Mitchell said, but our models would be consistent with having complex phytoplankton. The search for biosignatures is likely to remain an endeavor burdened by ambiguities. Definitive discoveries may be unicorns. There's never going to be one biosignature where everyone says, yes, we all agree, definitely life. Any one signature is always going to be debated. And that was the article entitled, Webb Telescope Detects a Possible Signature of Life on a Distant World. And this is written by Joel Achenbach for The Washington Post. And our next article is also going to come from The Washington Post, and that is entitled, La Niña Has Ended, but scientists now say it was stronger than it seemed. And this is written by Scott Dance and Ben Null for The Washington Post. La Niña is over, scientists declared on Thursday. And while the climate pattern was notably brief and has been waning, scientists said that the episode was not as weak as it once seemed. When the planet-cooling climate pattern emerged this year, scientists said it developed later and in a weaker state than they had expected. But the researchers said that it is because of the unusual warmth that has dominated the Pacific and other global oceans for the past 2 years that mask La Niña and defined by a patch of cooler than normal Pacific waters. La Niña, which the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration announced Thursday, marks the beginning of an uncertain spell in global weather, with no strong driver of the seasonal patterns and trends in the temperature or precipitation. Forecasters instead will have to look toward factors that influence the climate on a weekly to monthly scale. That can be harder to predict, even as some of the La Niña characteristics, such as drying influences in the southwest U.S. may increase the likelihood of an active fire season. But forecasters said the pattern that follows this one will drive more uncertainty than usual. The traditional measures of La Niña and its better known inverse, El Niño, looks at differences in the temperatures across specific zones of the Pacific. And based on that metric, La Niña episode that officially began this winter was weak and expected to have relatively minor impacts on global weather. But the surge in baseline ocean temperature tied to global warming made La Niña signature zone of cool Pacific waters look warmer than they otherwise would have been. Cooler waters mean a stronger La Niña. When accounting for that warming, the La Niña was closer to moderate strength, scientists said, fueling dry conditions across the southeast southern United States that have set the stage for a potentially active fire season for the Southwest. Scientists have been tracking the difference between the typical way La Niña and El Niño are diagnosed and a new standard that takes the trend of global warming into account. It's one of the first times we've seen such a large difference, says Emily Becker, Associate Director of the Cooperative Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Studies at the University of Miami. The index that takes into account nearly 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit of global warming more accurately captured the weather impacts La Niña caused in the U.S., she said. Had scientists at NOAA and other climate agencies used the new index to track La Niña's development, they also probably would have declared its arrival earlier and more accurately, says Pedro Denezio, an associate professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder. But it's not clear that the new measure is better. Scientists are investigating whether they should replace the traditional metrics applied to what is known as the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, with the new Global Warming Adjusted Index. Just because a new index worked better this time doesn't mean that it always will, Becker said. We're going to need to compare the two across many different situations with many different global background conditions before we can make a call like that, Nathaniel Johnson, a climate scientist at NOAA's Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Laboratory, wrote on the agency's ENSO blog. It was just 3 months ago that NOAA declared La Niña had arrived with requisite signs of cooler than normal waters along the equatorial Pacific and wind patterns that pushed warmer waters and towering clouds to the west toward Indonesia. Typical La Niña events can last from 9 months to 2 years. The planet's most recent La Niña lasted unusually for 3 years. But now, the planet is entering what are known as ENSO neutral conditions, without the influence of La Niña or El Niño, to suggest what sort of temperature or precipitation patterns that parts of the world can expect. That also means the outlooks for wildfire seasons in the west and hurricane season in the east will depend on monthly and weekly variations in weather patterns that cannot be as reliably predicted so far in advance. While La Niña's drying influence has raised the likelihood of an active fire season, recent early predictions of a busy but not hyperactive Atlantic hurricane season carry more uncertainty than usual, forecasters say. Forecast model updates for April have started to arrive, and the consensus is that neutral conditions will continue across the tropical Pacific into summer. However, from late summer into fall, forecasts start to diverge. Some models' outlooks suggest that the Pacific will warm, while others suggest that a dip back toward La Niña could occur, and this uncertainty is at least partially tied to the spring predictability pattern, the time of year when long-range forecasts for El Niño and La Niña have lower skill. If the ocean begins to lean even slightly toward El Niño or La Niña later this year, it can have an influence on hurricane season. La Niña-like patterns tend to cause winds that are more conducive to hurricanes in the Atlantic. For now, NOAA scientists estimate about a 43% chance of neutral conditions by late fall, with a 38% chance of La Niña and less than 20% chance of El Niño. But these odds are likely to shift as the climate patterns are difficult to predict at the time of the year, at least for now, during the Northern Hemisphere spring, when the climate is naturally in flux. After the spring, I think we'll see a clearer picture, Becker says. And that was the article entitled, La Niña Has Ended, but scientists now say it was stronger than it seemed. And this was written by Scott Dance and Ben Null for The Washington Post. And next, we are going to turn to this article entitled Another Win for Geology's Theory of Everything. And this comes from The Economist. As we all know, it does not do attributions for its individual articles. Plate tectonics could explain continental plateaus and mini mass extinctions. And this, again, comes from The Economist. Plate tectonics is geology's theory of everything. The realization in the 1960s that Earth's crust is made of fragments called plates, and that these plates can grow, shrink, and move around, explained the origins of mountain ranges, ocean trenches, volcanoes, and earthquakes. It also explained why continents drift over the planet's surface and thus, from time to time, come together to form an all-embracing supercontinent. Mountain ranges, ocean trenches, volcanoes, and earthquakes are, however, things that happen mainly where plate abut. Plate tectonics is not as good at explaining events and features elsewhere, particularly in continental interiors. These are often dominated by extensive highlands called plateau, which differs in forms from mountain ranges and are frequently bounded by giant escarpments. But, as he told the annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in Boston, Tom Gernon of Southampton University thinks he can bring these puzzling geographical features into the ambit of plate tectonics as well. His team's calculations suggest that they are caused by waves that ripple through Earth's mantle, the layer below the crust, when continents divide. They may even be responsible for some of the mini mass extinctions which punctuate the fossil record. his work began with a different, more eye-catching question, explaining how diamonds are propelled to the surface. Diamonds are crystals of carbon compressed into the form by the high pressure found in the upper mantle. Those discovered at the surface have been carried there by unusual explosive volcanoes called kimberlite pipes, which traverse the crust from bottom to top, erupting at ground level. Dr. Gernon and his colleagues proposed that the rifting of continental plates sets in motion a slow-moving wave through the semi-liquid rock of the mantle. Really slow-moving. They estimated travels at about 15 to 20 kilometers per million years. This wave of hot rock ablates the bottom of the crust, forming gas-charged magmas that erupt violently as kimberlite pipes. They then follow up this work by asking what other consequences their newly discovered waves might have. The answers, when they ran their models on a computer, were giant escarpments with plateaus behind them. These features were formed by a process known as isostatic rebound, in which the traveling wave removed the crust underside, causing the rock above to rise, rather as a balloon rises when its crew jettisons ballast. All this rapidly emerging highland will, though, be subject to immediate erosion. And that is where the extinctions come in. Really big extinctions, such as those at the end of the Permian and Cretaceous periods, have big sudden causes, like huge volcanic eruptions and collision with an asteroid, respectively. But these are interspersed by numerous smaller catastrophes that particularly affect the oceans and are associated with reduced levels of oxygen. This reduction of oxygen seems to happen because organic matter is being created in greater than normal quantities and then decomposing, sucking that element out of the water. Dr. Gernon thinks this is a result of pulses of erosion caused by plateau uplift fertilizing the oceans with phosphorus. That causes life to bloom, increasing the amount of organic matter available for decomposition. He argues, in particular, that the pattern of these mini-mass extinctions during the Jurassic and Cretaceous periods supports his hypothesis. It all, then, fits very nicely together. Geology's theory of everything continues successfully to defend its title. And that was the article, Another Win for Geology's Theory of Everything. Plate tectonics could explain continental plateaus and mini mass extinctions. And this was written for The Economist, which again does not do attribution of individual articles. And our next article will also come from The Economist and will be entitled, Scientists Are Getting to Grips with Ice. Climate change is making water freeze in unexpected ways. And as usual, there is no attribution for this particular article. Jack Frost is a tricky adversary as the mercury falls water's behavior becomes erratic, leading to ice and snow with physical properties that can vary enormously depending on environmental factors such as temperature and moisture, and that can complicate tasks as varied as developing new ice-repellent materials and predicting the likelihood of an avalanche. New research is suggesting ways to put this slippery field on firmer foundations. Ice is a complicated material, says Jean-Denis Brassard, an anti-icing specialist at the University of Quebec. Although one chunk may look like any other, each is a messy collection of individual crystals formed in ways that are sensitive to the conditions. Everything from the air pressure to the size of water droplets and the type of surface can affect the type of ice that will form and thereby its clinginess. To make matters worse, climate change brings with it different types of ice. This is a problem for those creating materials to protect aircraft, roads, bridges, and power lines from dangerous buildups of ice. At present, such materials are tested in a number of different ways, from checking how easily a layer of ice can be pulled vertically away from a surface, to measuring ice on ice friction. Writing in Cold Regions Science and Technology, Dr. Brassard and his colleagues argue that such tests do not replicate the way ice is removed from surfaces in the real world, which can lead to inconsistent and misleading results. Dr. Brassard's team has therefore built a tool that mimics the way people scrape their car windshields, rather unimaginatively called the Human Motion-Inspired Automated Apparatus. It uses compressed air to steadily push an angled blade across an icy surface. By measuring the force applied, it can rate the effectiveness of different de-icing techniques. Such a device will help ice cleaners and clearers tackle the novel forms of ice produced in a warming world. Climate change is increasing the likelihood of mixed phase precipitation, a weather forecaster's way of saying one of those wintry spells when you get a bit of everything. As a result, says Dr. Brassard, clients are increasingly finding hitherto unseen types of ice with no sense of how best to clear them. Then they come to see us, he says. Based on photographs and a handful of on-the-ground measurements, his team can try to replicate the unusual ice. Their device can then be used to test combinations of coatings and chemicals to see which might be most effective. Another type of ice test, carried out routinely on ski slopes, seeks to measure the stability of snowpacks in order to assess the chances of an avalanche. This is often done by counting how many taps it takes for cracks to appear and propagate in a column of snow. The tests are typically performed in three sets of increasing power, hinging the hand tap from either the wrist, the elbow, or the shoulder. Havard Toft, then a PhD student at the Center for Avalanche Research and Education at the Arctic University of Norway in Tromsø, was concerned that these avalanche tests were simply not reliable. Dr. Toft and his team, therefore, persuaded almost 300 avalanche experts to have the strength of their hand taps measured, collecting more than 8,500 data points in total. In a paper published in Natural Hazards and Earth Systems Science, Dr. Toft showed that different individuals delivered taps of the same type with varying degrees of force. Most striking, many experts produced more load with wrist taps than colleagues did with shoulder taps, which the researchers say could lead to some dangerous misclassifications of avalanche risk. The field should proceed with caution. And that was the article, Scientists Are Getting to Grips with Ice. And again, this comes from The Economist, which does not do attribution of individual articles. Our next article will be coming from the Scientific American, and it is entitled, Chaos Angle Explains Why Pedestrian Traffic Snarls to a Stop. In general, crowds like to form lanes to get across until too many people go in to too many different directions. And this is written by Gayoung Lee for the Scientific American. Humans walking in crowds tend to form orderly lanes. It's something we do without even knowing why, says Iker Zurigil, a physicist at the University of Navarro in Spain. But sometimes, such as in crosswalks during peak commuting times, that order turns into utter chaos. Mathematicians use physics models and gymnasium experiments to understand why and pinpointed a specific critical angle of the crowd's movement, 13 degrees, to explain why crowded pathways snarl to a standstill. This knowledge isn't just useful at rush hour. Managing a crowd efficiently in train situations, concerts, even in the streets is very important for safety and city building, explains Zurigil, who wasn't involved in the new study. In the recent paper published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, USA, mathematicians asked participants on either side of a gymnasium to walk to the other side without colliding with anyone. Each participant wore a little paper hat with a barcode to track their movements. The researchers considered each person as a particle in a physics model, a method they had previously used to show that people in crowds would form orderly lanes. But obviously, this doesn't always happen in real life. Humans are not perfect particles. We're idealizing them somewhat, explains study co-author Carol Basick, an applied mathematician at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. They do have some free will and offer different destinations or goals. People form these lanes as it suits them, and then they can split off again, adds study co-author Tim Rogers, a mathematician at the University of Bath in England. The researchers wanted to test what factors disrupted the natural occurring lanes. At first, Basick and Rogers considered that a few outliers running across the lane randomly could be to blame. but they found that there were no strict number of people that needed to deviate from their lane for foot traffic to start breaking down. The researchers instead measured the deviation of the entire crowd by averaging the angles at which each participant was walking to obtain what they called the crowd's angular spread. In the crowded gym, the researchers instructed participants to act out different scenarios. In one round, they were all told to walk as straight across as possible, or with essentially 0 degrees of deviation. This led to lane formation, as expected, but in other trials, each participant was directed to veer in different direction, increasing the crowd's angular spread. Only when the crowd's average walking angle hit 13 degrees from a straight line did the flow break down into a completely random structure. In other words, chaos. This may seem like a relatively small deviation from head on, and indeed, it's less than the angle of a pencil tip. But that average deviation was enough for participants' path of travel to severely intersect, causing people to pause, sidestep, and reroute, and impeding the flow. That said, knowledge of this chaos angle would be more useful for civil planners and engineers than individual pedestrians, who can control their own behavior but not that of others. In the real world, every situation would be different, Rogers says. But taking into account the physics and math of lane formation when spaces are designed, be they gymnasiums, stadiums, sidewalks, or crosswalks, offers an additional perspective on how people move in crowds. When people are designing spaces that pedestrians are going to use, Rogers says, they might want to think about what cues there are, what kind of restrictions of motions there are, what kind of destinations and origins are in this space. Considering angle spreads will give more chance for nice, smooth lanes to be normal. And that was the article entitled Chaos Angles Explains Why Pedestrian Traffic Snarls to a Stop. And this was written by Gayoung Lee for the Scientific American. Shortly after publishing the op-ed, Kennedy made false or unsupported statements about measles and the measles vaccine during a Fox Nation interview. Offit also drew attention to Kennedy repeatedly stating that the decision to vaccine is a personal one, even though a population needs high uniform levels of immunity, as high as 95%, to prevent the spread of measles because it's very contagious. After a second child with measles died this month, Kennedy wrote on social media, "The most effective way to prevent the spread of measles is the MMR vaccine." In response to the Scientific American, the HHS Hilliard highlighted ongoing research into the safety and efficacy of vaccines as a priority. Daniel Salmon, a vaccine safety researcher at Johns Hopkins University, is waiting to see how that pans out. Vaccine safety research has historically been underfunded, slow, and not very responsive to public concerns, he says. I've long argued for the need for more ongoing vaccine safety science resources, but it's got to be good science, robust, objective, rigorous. Salmons, however, is nervous about how Kennedy might define high-quality vaccine safety science. In March, federal officials announced the CDC, which is under the HHS, will conduct a study on vaccines and autism. Reportedly, this investigation will be led by a widely discredited researcher who has published anti-vaccine papers and was disciplined for practicing medicine without a license. Salmon says that subtle changes in how people talk about vaccine safety can help rebuild trust. For instance, he suggested stating that vaccines are very safe instead of broadly saying vaccines are safe. This can prevent mistrust when someone learns about extremely rare but possible adverse effects of vaccines. Then explain that adverse reactions are either mild and transient or very rare. People can handle the truth. Leon recalls two pivotal moments that eventually led her to vaccinate her daughters. The first was seeing her anti-vaccine friends misinterpret study findings on vaccine for pertussis or whooping cough, helping her to truly understand cherry picking of results or statements in papers to support already held beliefs. The second moment was after her cesarean delivery when a friend asked her, "Why don't you trust the science behind vaccines, but you trust the science of surgeons who perform that procedure?" Her friend was just asking me very valid, logical questions, Leon says. There was no animosity. That approach is similar to motivational interviewing, a technique that University of Colorado vaccine hesitancy researcher Sean O'Leary says can be very effective. The basic concept is having a conversation in such a way that a person makes a health behavior change because they now understand why that change fits with their own internal motivations, he said. O'Leary also emphasizes the importance of reminding people that the vast majority of parents are vaccinating their children according to the recommended schedule. Refusing vaccines is still an outlier behavior. A small amount of outlier behavior still endangers the larger community, however, which is why experts agree that a key strategy in building vaccine confidence is to mobilize and engage those who do vaccinate, reinforcing those social norms. Budenheim suggests that people pay attention to state legislative bills about vaccines, get to know their state legislators, and learn how to have productive conversations about difficult topics with people you love. But she adds, have realistic expectations. Belief and identity are tightly interwoven, so changing beliefs may require a painful or impossible shift in identity, she says. When engaging in or observing conversational online, Boonstra encourages people to do so in good faith. You want them to see that you're presenting a good, logical, compassionate argument for vaccines, he says. It's never going to happen in the moment. You might change their thinking over time. It took several months of conversations with her friends before Leon came around. What changed her mind wasn't being bombarded with links from online arguments or people telling me I was abusing my child, an accusation that made her dig in. O'Leary also advises avoiding arguments which only put people off. It's really more about having good conversations, becoming a trusted messenger, he says. Voices for Vaccines, a parent-led organization that works to increase vaccine confidence, has toolkits for talking about vaccines and courses on becoming a trusted messenger. Salmon recommends the online tool Let's Talk Shots for vaccine information based on people's specific concerns. Not everyone may change their mind about vaccines, but some, like Leon, eventually do so with time. What works is people asking questions and being relatively patient, Leon says. I'm very thankful for people who helped me and stuck with me. And that was the article entitled How to Talk About Vaccines in an Era of Scientific Mistrust. This was written by Tara Haley for the Scientific American. And while we have not completely run out of time, we have run out of time for any of the other articles that we have available. So we are just going to leave this off and sign out. And so, this was a reading of Science Today, and I am Alan Corbett, volunteer reader for Virginia Voice. As always, we all thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to talking with you again next week.